Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lise Doucette, the BBC's chief international correspondent. I'm in Jerusalem, and it's 1 year since the horrific events of October the 7th, the deadliest day in Israeli history. The day Hamas fighters went on a murderous rampage in towns and kibbutzes across southern Israel. It triggered a devastating war in Gaza, an unprecedented hostage crisis, and sparked what is now the darkest, most dangerous moment in this region. 1 year on, it's a moment to look back at how this war began, how it intensified in Gaza, and how month after month, tensions and violence have escalated across the region, drawing in armed groups linked to Iran, what it calls its axis of resistance, militias it's armed in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and most of all, Lebanon, where Iran's closest ally, Hezbollah, is in Israel's sights more than ever before. And archenemies, Iran and Israel, in direct confrontation. 1 year on, this is a war ringing alarm bells in capitals across the region and around the world, and causing unprecedented pain for people in the region, taking this age-old conflict into perilous, unpredictable terrain. Thank you for joining us as we take a look back at the dramatic events which have unfolded in southern Israel, in Gaza, and across the region over the past year. We want to reflect on all that's happened and look to where this war, unprecedented in so many ways, may now be heading. This is The Conflict, 1 year on.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
On October 7th, 2023, Hamas fighters broke through Israel's much-vaunted security barrier and stormed through towns and kibbutzes across southern Israel. By the end of the day, 1,200 people were killed and 251 Israelis and foreigners were taken hostage. It was an unprecedented day, seared in Israeli memory. 1 year on, around 100 hostages are still being held in Gaza, many fear dead. And Gaza now lies in ruin. The UN says more than 41,000 Palestinians have been killed, most of them women and children. The violence and suffering has spread to the occupied West Bank and across the region, escalating in recent weeks to an Israeli ground invasion of Lebanon and growing tension between two arch enemies, Israel and Iran. And we're joined now by three colleagues. First of all, to Jeremy Bowen, our international editor. Hello, Jeremy.
Hello, Lise.
And I think you're also in Jerusalem.
I am indeed, yes.
And Anna Foster is joining us from Lebanon, from Beirut. Hello, Anna.
Hello, Lise.
We had some very intense conversations last October when this crisis, which escalated into a full-blown war, was first starting. Jeremy, did you ever imagine then that this is where Gaza and the region would be now, that it would get this bad?
No, I didn't. I thought that Israel would pretty quickly take care of Hamas as a military force, and that when it had done the damage it felt was appropriate, that the Americans, the Egyptians, the Qataris perhaps would make sure there was a ceasefire, which was really the pattern of previous wars between Hamas and Israel. But this one is different. The huge number of Israeli casualties started it off, but since then, the nightmare that people really hoped wouldn't happen, which was the spread of the war, has happened. And, you know, for ages, people, analysts, journalists, politicians have been saying the region's on the brink. I think it's very much plunged over it now. And the question is where it's going, how dangerous a moment this is, I'd say extremely. And is there any way of finding an exit?
I remember, Jeremy, when arriving in Sderot in October, and the first person I interviewed was the mayor of Sderot, which, as you know, is the Israeli city closest to the Gaza border, a mile away, Alon Davidi. And I said to him, why do you think this military operation is going to be any more successful than all the other ones, the fifth Gaza war? And he said, because this time, when American, British and other leaders call us up, we are not, and tell us to stop because too many people have died, he said, we're not going to stop until our mission is done to destroy Hamas. And Jeremy, this is exactly what has happened. Prime Minister Netanyahu keeps proudly saying, I'm saying no, Israel must decide.
Yeah, and it's something, though, to do with, there are always complications, and one of them is, in fact, his war aims, saying total victory over Hamas, removing it as a political and military force. Well, I think plenty of military people would argue right now that they have destroyed Hamas as a military force. It in no way could it do now what it did on October the 7th last year. Politically, though, it's a different thing, because a lot of people in Gaza and in the West Bank support Hamas. Despite everything, despite the destruction, polls show it, as well as the fact that those sorts of beliefs that Hamas has, this nationalism backed up by strong religious conviction that the land is for Muslims, a lot of Palestinians agree with that. And you can't use, I mean, history has shown countless times that changing people's minds using the barrel of a gun doesn't work. You can kill them, but you won't stop the way that they think. So that's a difficulty. And also, there are, of course, multiple accusations in Israel that Netanyahu is prolonging the war not for a military necessity, but for his own political reasons. Joe Biden himself, Israel's greatest friend, has said something very similar about that. And essentially, that argument is that Netanyahu is dependent on ultranationalists who've said that if he stops the war, if there's a ceasefire, then they will bring down his government, and then he'll lose power. He might find himself back in court on the very serious corruption charges, which could end in a jail sentence that he faces. And at the same time, that has caused enormous anger and frustration among many Israeli hostage families. Why? Because they believe that Netanyahu is essentially abandoning their people and saying, no, actually, what matters is keeping me going, keeping the war going, doing what I want to do politically. And the hostages, well, bad luck. That's the view of many families.
And Anna, you're back in Beirut when this war began. You were in southern Israel, and sometimes in northern Israel. We spoke many times, and now you've returned to Beirut, where you spent years as a Middle East correspondent. Did you think last year at this time that it would come to this, a war which includes Lebanon as well?
I was unsure at the time, actually, Lise, because as you rightly say, I spent a lot of time in northern Israel a year ago. And I was there when those Hezbollah rockets started being fired across the border from Lebanon into Israel. And as people were evacuating, I remember being there one day actually to do an interview with a woman, and the sirens went off and we had to run into her safe room, you know, dank sort of pools of water on the floor. Nobody knew what was going on. People were terrified. And it's those people who've been out of their homes for a year now who Israel says it wants to return. But also now, a year on, I'm here in Lebanon and seeing a similar fear and terror and confusion from people who've now been forced from their homes in the south of Lebanon. It was my feeling a year ago that Lebanon didn't want this. And in fact, you know, you need to remember that Lebanon and Hezbollah, while they're wrapped up together, they are two different things. Hezbollah, it has its sort of links with the Lebanese state, but it's not the Lebanese state. And when you consider all of the many layered crises that Lebanon has had and the parlous situation it was already in, I didn't think that Lebanon really had the appetite for this war or indeed the resource to carry it out. And I think what we saw a couple of weeks ago with those attacks on the pagers and the walkie-talkies, and I think that has forced the hand of Hezbollah and led to everything we've seen in the last week or so, where things really have taken on this new pace and this new momentum.
Yes, all of us have been saying in our reporting about how one week after another, red lines are being crossed. Everyone is reeling, and most of all, the people on the ground. And this is a really good moment to say, I believe our colleague Rushdie Abu-Alouf is joining us now from Istanbul. Rushdie, you're on the line?
Yes, I am.
Great to have you with us. Rushdie, let's go back to when this Gaza war began, triggered by the events, the attacks of October the 7th. You were in Gaza that day, the BBC correspondent there. When it all began, when the details started coming out of it, what had happened across the border, what were you thinking at the time?
We were just been trying to start our daily morning as usual, sending the kids to school, and suddenly rockets were flying everywhere. And what went to my mind at that moment, that maybe Israel killed like a senior Hamas or Islamic Jihad commander and they are retaliating. But very quickly, we realize that something really big is happening when we start to see the Hamas militants breaking through the fence and going inside. And we realize from that moment that it's a turning point in the history of this conflict. This is something never happened before. I just got my car and drove straight away to the office and start to plan for the worst. But in personal level, I was straight away advising my wife to go out of Gaza. And I told her, this is a very little chance. You have to take it immediately because it is going to be a huge revenge on Gaza. Well, she didn't take the chance because she was not realizing that we will be a war for a year. And for the next 5-6 weeks, we were displaced 5-6 times, and we were trying to continue do the story and also look after the family in a war zone, which is quite not easy. And a year after, we are still stuck at that moment. We are still stuck where this war started back in the October the 7th last year. And it's hard to go back to where we were, because here in Istanbul, yes. Yeah.
When you say that you told yourself that day to prepare for the worst, did you ever imagine that the worst is what we see now in Gaza, your home, a place which lies in utter ruin and so much loss, so much loss?
Never, never. I was expecting a huge Israeli retaliation, airstrikes, destroying Hamas tunnels, trying to even ground invasion, but I never ever expect this scale of destruction and expect that number of people, about over 40,000 people killed, like 15,000 kids and women, and there is about 10,000 people are missing. And I believe at least 50 to 60% of the buildings and infrastructure and schools, universities, hospitals are completely destroyed. When I left Gaza back in November, my wife asked me, she said, how is going to end? I said, it's going to take 6 months to end it. But now I can't see any way out of it easily.
Let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back to what happened on October the 7th last year, what Israelis say is a day that changed Israel forever. Jeremy, you made a visit to a kibbutz and did some very powerful reporting of what you saw there. Let's just listen to your report at that time.
There were still a lot of bodies of the Hamas gunmen lying basically where they were killed, decomposing. The weather is hot. You could smell rotting flesh very, very, you know, distinctly there. So what we did was we saw that they were taking out these bodies, putting them in body bags, and it became clear that the only reason why they were doing it right now is because until this morning, they weren't in control of the area, which I think is also an important point to bear in mind when we talk about whether or not the Israelis are going to get on with a land operation in Gaza. If they are still trying to stabilize their rear and recapture their own territory, at this point, it is not yet time or readiness. They haven't got the readiness, anyway, I think, for them to go on the offensive.
Jeremy, it's hard. What was happened was horrific and hard to see, to report on.
Yeah, that was the 10th of October. It was at Kibbutz Kfar Aza, which is one of the first targets of Hamas because it's right on the border. When we went there with the Israeli army, along with a lot of other journalists, they took us in. It was still basically a battle zone. Decomposing bodies, soldiers still shooting, decomposing bodies, I should say, of Hamas fighters. The Israelis, dead Israelis, were still being found in the ruins of their homes and being carried out in body bags. So it was a very stark picture of what had happened. All the soldiers and police in the locality going there, even though, you know, we have full permission to be in the area, and we're actually part of the time in an official convoy getting there, were very jumpy, going to roadblocks, because they were still worried there were Hamas gunmen in the area. I mean, they were reeling. The Israeli army was absolutely reeling from what had happened. So were the political and intelligence people, because they just didn't think that this would happen, that there would be an attack like this out of Gaza. They hadn't planned for it. There had been warning signs, which they'd ignored. A lot of people who follow the Middle East, and myself included, thought that the tensions and the absence of hope and the radical nature of the violent Jewish settlers in the West Bank and the ultra-nationalists and the government who were egging them on, that all that was a really potent mix and would end in some kind of an explosion. But I expected that might be in Jerusalem or the West Bank. I did not think it would come out of Gaza, and I certainly didn't think it would be so organized that within a day they'd kill 1,200 people, Hamas, mostly Israeli civilians, which guaranteed a huge Israeli response. As Rushdie said, everybody knew it was coming. But then has now, it started a chain of actions and consequences which have ignited the whole region.
And that 1 year on, that grief is still mixed with anger, and many of the residents of the kibbutzes have not been able to return home. And then there is the agony of the families whose loved ones were taken hostage. Anna, you spoke to a mother, Gali Dan, whose husband, Tzachi, was taken hostage after their 18-year-old daughter, Mary Mayan, was murdered in front of the whole family. And we believe Tzachi is still being held hostage. Let's just listen to your report then.
For many of us, you know, trying to put those moments into words is enormously difficult. Sometimes there aren't words. But Gali found them and she shared them with us.
Tzachi is broken. Tzachi is broken. He saw his daughter die. He saw her getting shot in her head and die. Next to him, his daughter that had just celebrated turning 18. The house is full of balloons and congratulations and blood.
And it's the same thing we hear from the hostage families. Immense grief mixed also with anger that they're loved ones haven't come home yet.
Yeah, and when you hear a story like Gali's, and I remember very clearly that day and sitting down with her, and she was, as you would imagine, in a terrible state. Everything she'd been through, that she'd watched her own daughter be killed in front of her, that she'd watched her husband be taken away, and the last thing she wanted to do was to dig into that and speak about it. But she and others wanted to do that because they wanted the world to know those particular stories, and they wanted to keep those stories of those hostages in the public mind, because in those days they really thought that by keeping those names, those faces, not letting people forget about them, then that would help efforts for a ceasefire, a hostage deal, whatever it may be. And you're right in saying that Sahi is one of those people that we still don't know what has happened to him. He is still presumably being held in Gaza. We don't know if he's alive or dead. And as you say, Lise, just so many of those stories, each one something that has changed the life of not just that person that was taken hostage, but the families and loved ones and friends around them as well.
And I know you have to leave, so I'm going to ask you one last question, because then I'm going to have to go. Mm-hmm. And at the moment that we're recording, there's an expectation that Israel is going to retaliate against Iran. And Iran has said they will then respond with an attack against Israel. And you're in Beirut. Is there a sense there that there's no end in sight for this at the moment?
I think people here, they have no idea how this might end. And on the other side of the city today, you can see those plumes of smoke rising into the air. This is Beirut. This is the Lebanese capital city, again, looking like a war zone. People have said to me, they feel that it on a different scale, that it looks and sounds like Gaza. You can hear the drones. There's whole areas of the southern suburbs where buildings have been razed to the ground. And people don't know what the answer is, and they don't know how far this might go.
And I know you have to dash now, but thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you, Lise.
Jeremy, we often use the word unprecedented to describe what's been unfolding across the region this year. You see a light, or to use that terrible phrase, that it's going to get worse before it gets better, or the phrase now being used now that it's being escalated to de-escalate?
Well, this phrase, escalate to de-escalate, I think is a bit nonsensical. The theory is you go in really hard, as Israel has done in Lebanon, and so coerce your enemy that they throw up their hands and go home and say, OK, yeah, we agree, we won't do it anymore. Well, that hasn't worked, because Hezbollah are still firing into Israel. And now that Israel has invaded the south, they're fighting back, and they've killed some Israeli soldiers. They're fighting a very sophisticated modern army, and Hezbollah will undoubtedly lose a lot of men. But they seem to be determined to fight on. So that, I think, deals with this illusion about escalate to de-escalate. I think that's just someone's pipe dream. I think the only way, and speaking to senior officials, diplomats and so on, the only chance is to try and get a ceasefire in Gaza. That is where it started, and that's where it might begin to finish if they succeed in doing that. But all the indications are that it's not going to happen. The ceasefire talks that were going on in Qatar are deadlocked. Both Hamas and Israel are reluctant to go further towards each other. Certainly Hamas, and this was confirmed to me by the Qataris, say that when they thought they had a deal, when the Qataris thought they had a deal there, and the Americans announced as much, the Israeli delegation came back with more demands from Netanyahu. That's also been widely reported in the Israeli media and other parts of the international media. So anyway, ceasefire talks at the moment, not much chance. After the US elections, possibly. Depends what Biden does in his last few months, and of course depends who wins. I see that today in one of the papers, which I had a quick look at, Mr. Trump was saying that Israel should bomb Iran's nuclear facilities, which I think Iran would take as an existential attack and would hit back as hard as they could. So, to be honest, Lise, I don't see much to be positive about. I think the way that they could possibly try and open a little window for diplomacy is that Gaza ceasefire. And if you think about it, you know, it was only just over a week ago at the UN General Assembly that the Americans, helped by the Brits and various others, were pretty confident that they could get a 21-day truce in Lebanon. The Lebanese foreign minister says that Hassan Nasrallah had agreed to it. The Americans seem to think that they had influence with the Israelis. They said as much, that the Israelis had knew about the proposal in their briefings, the Americans. And then Netanyahu did a very strong speech. He'd already authorized the assassination of Nasrallah. And an hour or two after the speech, it became clear that they'd done this massive airstrike in the southern suburbs. And since then, well, as you mentioned, the ladder of escalation. And that's a phrase used by strategists who study these things to try to describe the way that wars speed up, how they go from crisis to disaster and then beyond that. And so the next big thing, what is Israel going to do? Is Israel really going to hammer Iran? If it does, Iran will respond without question. And then if you're getting into a business of some kind of ballistic missile exchange, ping pong, if you like, then that is really dangerous for everyone.
Jeremy, I know you have to go as well. So thank you so much for making time to look back with us and also to look forward as dark as it still looks.
Thank you, Lise. That's what we're here for.
And Rishi, there was that moment you shared with us on the Conflict podcast last year when you fear that even your wife and children had been at risk. How do you think back on that now? Fortunately, your family is safe. As you mentioned, many Palestinian journalists had to leave, even though most of you wanted to stay to cover this story.
Yes, including me. I wanted to stay at that time, but I had to leave because of the family. Well, otherwise, the family was like pushing me to leave because they were really at risk. I mean, they were. I remember the last few days in Gaza, I decided I told them, come and stay with me in the hospital close to me. So if we whether live together or die together, I don't want to be at this position when I am in one place and you are in another place. It's a big relief for me to have the family out of Gaza. But, you know, I still have my father there. I still have my sister, my wife. Has her entire family in Gaza, her brothers, her sisters. I have to follow everything day and night in Gaza. Firstly, because I still do my job and I still report the story from there. But more important is because we still have all of our loved ones there and we have to be in touch with them.
Rishi, we hope your family and your friends, everyone stays safe. Thank you so much for all of your reporting in Gaza and outside of Gaza, too.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Liz.
Thank you for listening to our conversation and hope there have been little glimmers of light in all this darkness. If you have any questions about what is happening on the ground, what is happening with any of us with our reporting and the reporting of our colleagues across the region, please do get in touch. Email us at theconflict@bbc.co.uk. Until the next time, goodbye.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.